I'm Terry Flanagan. I'm a biologist and a secondary school teacher, and I'm proud to be the reporter on Mooney Goes Wild.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
On today's programme, we meet Oxford University's virus hunter, Professor Stephen Baker. Lorcan O'Toole talks to us about the recent illegal and mass poisoning of buzzards in County Cork. And Terry Flanagan discovers some unwelcome visitors in the Royal Canal.
The canal, it's an oasis of wildlife, Terry. It's amazing. You know, we're on the fringe of the city here, and we've waterhens, we've ducks, we've swans, we've herons, we've the odd kingfisher. Oh, beautiful nature here. And then in the water itself, there's plenty of pike and perch and roach.
And then you have terrapins.
Terrapins.
To ruin it.
To ruin it all.
To get the programme started, we have a competition for you. A wonderful prize it is too. A year-long family membership to Birdwatch Ireland. Where would you get it? Only right here. And here's the question. What is the relationship between this young lady, Greta Thunberg...
This is all wrong. I shouldn't be up here. I should be back in school on the other side of the ocean. Yet you all come to us young people for hope. How dare you?
And this lady, who represented Sweden at the Eurovision Song Contest in 2009. Think you know the answer, all you have to do is email mooney@rte.ie. Good luck! I can't get that high myself. What is the relationship between that lady singing, who represented Eurovision Song Contest of Sweden 2009, and Greta Thunberg? I'm in the studio. We're live. You can text 51551 or email mooney@rte.ie about anything at all. Well, usually it has to do with wildlife. It is a wildlife programme, you understand. So I'm all on my own. I mean, when I came in, I thought Richard was going to be here. I thought Aina was going to be here. I thought Niall Hatch from Birdwatch. None of them are here. Where, Aina, Richard, May, where are you guys?
Don't worry, Derek. I'm here. Would
where?
I let you down? I'm actually outside the front door.
Oh.
And I'm on my way in when, whom do I meet but Bridget Nicholas? And Bridget Nicholas is a damsel in distress.
Ooh.
And she has a terrible story to tell me. So rather than me telling you the terrible story, Bridget Nicholas is going to tell you the terrible story herself.
Good.
So I was walking out the front door and I decided to go over, get myself a coffee over in the canteen, casual as you like. And I was coming along here on the footpath and I just shudder even thinking about it. And I was walking along and next thing I hear this like near me. And I look up and there is like a massive crow.
Oh, not Joe Duffy.
Aina, you can tell me if it's a crow or a jackdaw or what. But it was coming for me near my head. I kind of like leant down and I was wondering, did I imagine it or am I being paranoid or what?
So, how did you hear that big bun like you have now?
I did actually. Yeah.
Well, do you think it was attacking your hair or was it your head or your shoulder? Which bit was it going for?
I thought it was going for my head. Definitely my head. And I definitely thought, oh my God, it's going for my hair. So then I was kind of like yelping and jumping around. And then I kind of looked up to see, am I seeing this right? And it came for me again. And then because, as you can see, we're in the trees here. There's a few trees together. So I just like ran through towards the canteen. I felt like I was in The Birds or something in the Hitchcock film.
Now, you haven't been on the Blue Smarties or anything like that, no. Are you the only person, or I know there's not too many people here, but are you the only person that has been so attacked, or do you know of anybody else that has been attacked like this?
Well, sure, like, I was shaking as I was, but then I texted some of the girls and I said, lads, you never told me that there's crows attacking people outside the radio centre. And they said, oh, Bridge, like, actually, Tara from Shona Work Programme and I think someone else got attacked as well. And I thought they were pulling my leg, but actually, they're not. So I'm not the first person and I hope to be the last.
And is it all women that are being attacked? Do they go for the men as well, the fellas with baldy heads? Or is it only the hairy women that they're going for?
I don't know. And I don't know, actually. And somebody else said to me, did you have hair clips in? But, like, wouldn't it be a magpie that would go for my hair clip?
We won't go down the magpie route because I have Niall Hatch here. And Niall, of course, Birdwatch Ireland man. If anyone knows the reason why, it'll be Niall Hatch. Niall, what's going on? Why are they attacking Bridget?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned there about that, the hair clips, and ruling that out, because it's kind of a bit of a misnomer that the crows will go for shiny objects. You know, they're interested in novel things, really, and that's maybe more what to do with it. But from your description of it, it sounds to me like it's a bird called a hooded crow. So in some parts of Ireland, that's the scald crow or the grey crow, the big black and grey fella that you see around the place. And my best guess with this is that it's some sort of territorial response. I'm guessing they're nesting nearby.
Actually, as you say that, there were, like, when I was going past, like, nearby in the grass, there were, like, smaller, like, of the same version, smaller baby, like, maybe they were babies, I don't know now, but they were fluffier, so maybe that's a baby, and, but they were, like, not lying, but they were sitting in the grass, so, like, they weren't, like, walking around or anything, so were they being their young?
It sounds like it. So I think we're getting to the bottom of this. Yes, so they were probably just recently fledged young of that crow. So it could have been the mum or the dad.
They don't actually have their nests on the ground, so they don't have a nest up in trees.
That's right, they nest high in the trees, but it's not unusual for birds then to leave the nest, the youngsters, before they can properly fly. So they come down, they're a little bit little bit clueless, they don't know much about the world, and so it still falls to mum and dad to look after them. And they would see a human being as being a bit of a threat. And unlike most birds, which can't do anything about it, the crows know that they can be intimidating when they want to be. So it's kind of a warning, I'm guessing, to try and keep people away from the chicks. I think it's happening a bit more this year than in other years, because a lot of the birds have become less accustomed to having people around them, maybe. Especially, you know, I'm guessing around the radio centre would normally be a lot busier than it has been in the last few weeks. And so I'm thinking that perhaps this time the crows are just being a little bit oversensitive when someone walked by.
So they'll only be there for a week. Well, do you think we'll go over and have a look, or do you think Derek would murder us if we don't go in straight at once? But they wouldn't have been long on the ground anyway, would they, before they would have got a bit more sense and gone away. So even if we went over to look now, they're probably gone. Because when did this happen, Bridget?
This happened earlier today, and so, like, it was really quiet around the place. Like, no one could see me, thank God, because I would have seemed like a right Aegis around the place yapping about. But then if that happens again, what should I do?
You go by the long way around. And we're going by the long way around back into the studio before Derek becomes terribly lonely altogether. Yeah. Social isolation is all very well, but not for Derek in the studio. Right, Derek, back to you. We're coming in.
Right, thank you very much indeed, Aina and Niall. We'll see you very shortly while they're making their way. And let me tell you what's happening tomorrow evening in our normal time slot of 10 p.m. right here on RT Radio 1. So for the summer months, we're actually going to broadcast some of our documentaries from the archive. As you probably know, the programme is 25 years on air. So over that last quarter of a century, we've made some fantastic documentaries. And tomorrow night's documentary is about the swallow from Egg to Africa, presented by Eric Dempsey. In this clip, you hear Eric talking to farmer Declan Manley, who rings swallows every year on his farm.
I have a tape of a swallow call. Actually, it's a CD.
Okay.
And I have an amplifier.
Yeah.
So basically what I do is when I open the net, I'll put on the swallow track, put it on repeat, so it keeps playing a swallow song and swallow call.
Ah, okay.
And the theory is then the swallows, like that, as you said, there's about 20 acres of maize here, so they could roost anywhere in this maize. But if they think there's swallows in there already, the other ones will tend to join them.
So basically what you're doing is you're fooling
them. I'm fooling them to think that there's a little group of swallows just here beside the net.
And then the safety in numbers, of course, exactly. So that should attract them in, will it? It'll be very interesting to see how it works.
You're going to unfurl the net.
Yeah, and if you want to find out what happens, all you got to do is tune into Mooney Goes Wild tomorrow right here on RTE Radio 1.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
Hello, I'm Caoimhe de Barra from Throcra. Your Throcra box can make a big difference to some of the world's most vulnerable people. Thank you for holding on to it. We would now like you to count the contents and donate. simply call 1850 408 408, visit throcra.org, or check with your local parish for the safest way to return it. Make it count. Please donate now. Throcra, until love conquers fear.
COVID-19 has forced us to change how we do lots of things, from the way we work to the way we live our lives. But one of the things that will never change is where to go for trusted advice. Your solicitor continues to provide essential services. They are open and ready to help you in these uncertain times, supporting you with both personal and business issues. If you need advice from someone you can trust, who's working for you and in your corner, you should talk to your solicitor. From the Law Society of Ireland.
From RTE News and Current Affairs, Pandemic.
There was a sense that people in nursing homes were actually going to be okay because there were restrictions, etc. And that totally forgot about the fact the people who are most likely to be bringing in COVID were in fact the staff.
News, updates and analysis from RTE's reporters and correspondents. Pandemic. rte.ie/podcasts.
Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
You can visit the website anytime you like. It's rte.ie/Mooney. It's great to be here on Sundays. It really is. And we're delighted to have your company. Now, turtles, terrapins and tortoises, or tortoises, depending on how you have your tea and how you say it yourself. What's the difference between them? Well, I'm told it all comes down to where they live. With more on this, we have our own biologist and secondary school teacher, Mr. Terry Flanagan. Terry, you're welcome to the programme on Sundays.
Isn't it great to be back on
Terrific.
Sundays again? God, how long is it since we were here on Sundays? It must be years ago. We used to be on the Sunday morning, about 10 o'clock, and before that it was Saturday morning, I think 10 o'clock. We did a Saturday afternoon, I think, at one stage. We did a Friday afternoon
for many
years. And now we're back live again on a Sunday evening.
Where it all began. It's great to be here. I'm thrilled. I really am thrilled, Skinny. I can't tell you how much. Anyway, Terry, turtles, terrapins and tortoises. What is the difference between them?
Well, they're all very, very similar. They're all reptiles, but really it comes down to where they live. Mm. Tortoises live on land, and probably the best known tortoises would be tortoises on the Galapagos Islands, the ones that Darwin studied there back, 200 years ago or so. Turtles, they live in the sea, and the terrapins, they're freshwater living versions of the turtles. But one thing's for sure, they're not native to Ireland.
Why are we talking about them today?
Because we're getting lots of calls on the programme about them, and about them being present on inland waterways, things like rivers and canals and that. So we're getting more and more reports of these. So why are they there? How did they get there? And how good are they for the environment? So with that in mind, I headed off to the Royal Canal in Clonsilla, very close to where I live. And I met with Jim Nolan. Jim is a local man. His house actually backs onto the canal. He's walked that canal for years. And he told me about these terrapins that have been popping up along the canal here in Dublin in what's not their natural habitat.
Now just take it handy here, Terry. Just slow down along here. You see this big tree, just beyond the big tree. See a man down there?
Oh, I can see him. Yeah, he's in there on a little kind of a ledge.
He is.
It's almost like a leaf, isn't it?
That's his favourite sunbathing spot.
Right.
Once the sun comes out, you'll see him there, Terry.
And how long have you seen these guys on the canal?
Terry, I've been walking the canal for nearly 30 years now.
Right.
And the first time I came across him was about 5 or 6 years ago.
Right.
Up beyond Westminster, at the back of Westminster. He was on the far side of the canal, and this fellow was ginormous. He was the size of a big dinner plate, out sunning himself.
And do many people see this guy or see any of
them? It's a source of great curiosity when people see them, Terry.
Yeah.
I mean, you see people say, hey, what's that at all? They can't believe they're there. They think it's a tortoise. Some people come, oh, there's a tortoise over there. Yeah. But they're the turtles, little turtles, you know.
And how many of them do you think are there here in the canal?
It's hard to say, Terry. At times you see a half dozen along the stretch here. And then
that many?
About a half dozen in various spots along
the
stretch.
Because the most I've seen at any one time is three.
Three, is it? Yeah. Well, they're very territorial. You never see them together, Terry. There's always one at a time. Never ever together, you know.
Yeah.
Out sunning themselves.
How do you think they got here then?
I will tell you, the story is that people say that pets that were discarded, they got too big for the tanks at home, and people put them into the canal here.
What do the local people think?
Well, it's a little bit concerning, Terry, because I mean, they're not natural to the environment here.
Yeah.
So they can't be good. And again, the survival rate, I don't know what it is, because the big fella I mentioned there a few minutes ago, I haven't seen him in but 2 or 3 years. So I suspect he's passed away.
What do you think should happen to him?
it's hard to say, Terry. How do you round them up? I suppose that the best thing to do is put a stop to people putting them, make people aware that they shouldn't be going, putting them into the canal or putting them into any of the riverways, because I'm not natural to the area.
And you know, all the time we're talking, he's still there in that same spot and he's just sunning himself.
He's sunning himself. But you move close to him, Terry. He's like a bullet. Right. The first thing that caught me is how quick they can be. I went to move close to him one day and bump, he's gone into the water like a bullet. You know, you think they're like a tortoise, they're slow, but these lads are very fast and straight under the water, gone.
So that was Terry talking to Jim Nolan along the banks of the Royal Canal. But is there a problem here, Terry? Are they not just an added attraction for walkers along the towpath?
Well, actually, they are, because I see people stopping and watching them and having a look at them and throwing bread into them.
For sure.
Are they good for the environment? That's the real question. And I don't think they are. They're non-native species. They're in there. They may be carrying disease. They may be interacting with the native plants and animals. They may be eating. They may be disrupting food change. And they may be disrupting food chains. There's a whole lot that's going on that we don't really know about. So I met up with Colly Ennis of the Herpetological Society of Ireland, and I put those questions to him.
Basically, people are buying small, very cute looking turtles from pet shops, and in a matter of a year, a turtle can grow double, treble, four times its size, depending on what it's been fed and if it's been kept in correct conditions. And even if it's kept in a relatively large tank, they get very smelly and they get very big. And then what happens next is people will go to try and find a rescue centre for terrapins and turtles, and there just isn't one available because everywhere is full up. And then what happens is they get released into ponds and canals and rivers. And unfortunately for the animal in question, in our climate the way it is at the moment, it's a very slow and prolonged death for them, because they have fat reserves that they would in their natural habitat, which is mainly North America. They'll have a lot warmer kind of summers and they will be able to replenish their fat reserves and build them up. And then they have very, very cold winters, which force the animals to shut down. Whereas we tend to have milder winters. And that means that they're still plodding along throughout the winter, using up these fat reserves. And basically, it's 3 or 4 years of an animal very slowly dying.
Do you have any records of them breeding here in Ireland?
Nothing official. There has been some anecdotal talk that very small terrapins have been found on lakes with very large terrapins.
So it looks like mammy and daddy and the family.
It could seem that way, but yeah. Again, it's very hard to say without evidence. You need to see multiple babies to prove that they've bred successfully here. It seems highly unlikely given our climate at the moment, but down the road, who knows?
Worst case scenario, what could happen?
They become established here in large numbers. If they become established on the likes of a canal, it's very hard to eliminate a species from an area that's so vast. If you take the Grand Canal or the Royal Canal, for example, it'd be very hard to walk the length of that, find nests, eliminate all the animals. So, yeah, it is quite worrying.
So what should people do?
You shouldn't buy terrapins. You shouldn't buy them for your kids. They are unsuitable pets unless you have very specialised heated ponds. And that's exactly what they need. They don't do well in glass tanks because reptiles suffer from this syndrome called invisible barrier syndrome. The only way you should keep a terrapin is if you have a large heated pond.
And finally, if you come across one in a pond or in a canal, what should you do?
There's not much really you can do, to be honest with you. And that's just because there are no rescue centres at the moment available for these animals. So unfortunately, the best thing to do is just leave it be. Because if you do take it on board, it's going to be your responsibility.
Have you still seen them, Terry? Are they still there since you made that report for us?
Well, that report was only made during the week. And I was up the canal with the dog just this morning. Yep. And yes, I saw one of them. Now, I've seen, as I said on the report there, I've seen up to 3 at the one time. So there are at least 3. Jim Nolan reckons there's 5 or 6 of them there. So if we're saying that there's 3 or 5 or 6, there's probably a lot more of them.
So what should people really be doing with pets they don't want? I mean,
well, they shouldn't be getting them in the first place.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you bought a thing as little and now it's huge. I mean, it happens with dogs, it happens with other things. What should people do with them?
Well, that's a very good question. I think the first thing is, think before you buy anything. Don't buy something like that because...
Ah, mammy, please. Ah, please. And I'll mind it and I'll take it for a walk and I'll mind it.
You'll do that for a
couple
of
years. Somebody walking a terrapin.
Yeah, I know.
But it is an issue, though. I mean, there are a lot of very unsuitable pets for sale, unfortunately, and people really have to have specialist training and knowledge. I mean, for example, sometimes you see things like owls for sale. It's a totally unsuitable pet. It could be quite dangerous. You also see things like Siberian chipmunks for sale. These are potential to become a really invasive species. You see in places like Brussels, for example, that species is run rampant. Very cute little thing, of course, looks adorable. But actually, they have a nasty bite and a pretty vicious temperament.
Should there be control on pet shops in Ireland as to what they're allowed to be selling in the first place?
I certainly think that
there must be, Aina.
Yeah, maybe they're not being sold in pet shops. That's another point.
Well, in some places, I mean, I think that there does need to be more regulation on this, but I think also people need to be aware that when you're buying something that's cute, you should research it. You should make sure that you know how to look after it. Because these terrapins, okay, they can't become established in the wild in Ireland because of our climate. Many other species can, and it is quite a worry because they can cause big problems for agriculture.
Well, I always think, you mentioned agriculture, I think of the ring-necked parakeets, which are absolutely beautiful.
They absolutely are.
And if you go to the UK now, you can pretty much, you hear them before you see them.
Noisy, quark, 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 noisy one.
And then you look up and you see these beautiful tropical birds, and you'll see them all over London, and they destroy crops.
They absolutely do, and that's again an escaped pet which was either deliberately released or escaped from captivity. They've got a big feral breeding population in southern England, and also in places like Amsterdam, Spain have them as well. Brussels.
That's in Brussels,
they do. And
are there some of them in Dublin now at the moment?
Well, in Birdwatch Ireland now, over the course of the winter, we got a report of a flock of about four of them flying around between Rathfarnham and Tallaght, that kind of area. We've had reports from Walker.
Describe what they look like.
So they're a sort of about the size of a pigeon with a big long tail. They're bright, bright green with a red beak. And as you said, they're very attractive birds.
They're called ring-necked because they've got a rosy red ring around their neck.
They're kind of like parrots, really. I mean,
you look at it and you think there's a parrot. Like it's a lovely green parrot with a long tail. And they're native to Asia and Africa. One of the only parrots actually that's native to both of those continents. But the thing is, a lot of the countries where they live, like Pakistan, for example, they get very cold in the winter. So they're able to survive European winters without any problems.
Uh-huh.
And so what happens is that they then become established. And as you said, they can pose big problems for agriculture, particularly for fruit orchards as well, because they eat lots of fruit.
And of course, would they come to bird tables if you were putting out food in the winter for birds? You might see them.
They do. They rely very much on food at bird tables, which is another reason why they become so popular in Britain, because so many people are feeding birds there. So beautiful bird, and lovely to look at, but it's not good when a non-native species becomes established like that. It can have big knock-on.
They really are beautiful. You can email Mooney at rte.ie or text 51551. Maybe you've spotted a ring-necked parakeet. maybe you've spotted a redneck parakeet. A ringneck parakeet where you live, text 51551, or some terrapins where you are, 51551.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
Whether you love watching slimy gore in the latest horror movie or the latest videos on how to make slime online, if you watch them on a TV, then you must have a TV licence. It's the law. That's just one of the terms and conditions of life in Ireland. Get one at tvlicense.ie or at any post office. Brought to you by the Government of Ireland.
Here's to our local independent businesses. For the last few months, they have been adapting and surviving, finding new ways to serve our communities. At Bank of Ireland, we're doing our bit. And because your financial well-being is our priority, our dedicated business teams can help you take the next step. So we can all keep tapping, clicking and collecting. And one day, getting back to what we all do best. We can, we will, begin. Bank of Ireland is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.
Romeo's, so fresh, our chip potatoes still think they're in a local field.
Our fish, so fresh, they still think the tide is about to come in.
At Romeo's, we deliver freshness.
You order, we prepare, we cook, we deliver.
Romeo's, it's Italian for fresh.
Well, we think it is.
Now, Romeo's announce yet another place to source your fresh food delivery. Romeo's, City West Dublin.
Local delivery from any of our 17 stores.
Delivery charge may apply.
Romeo's.ie. Ready when you are.
Behind every inspiring moment and every person who changed the world, there's a story.
Champion of the world.
Introducing Sky Documentaries. Get the story behind the story with award-winning exclusive documentaries and over 100 titles on demand. A brand new channel at no extra cost for Sky TV customers. Sky Documentaries. Available now. Requires Sky TV.
Email mooney@rte.ie.
You can visit our website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney, or you can text us now on 51551. Now, you may remember how earlier this month it came to light that 22 buzzards were found dead near Timoleague in County Cork. It was later confirmed that all had died after eating the highly toxic and banned substance carbofuran. Buzzards are fully protected in Ireland under the EU Birds Directive, and this is the biggest known illegal act against birds of prey in Ireland. Lorcan O'Toole is General Manager of the Golden Eagle Trust, and he joins us now from the studio in Donegal. So, Lorcan, will you begin by taking us back and tell us exactly what happened near Timoleague in County Cork earlier this year?
Good evening, Derek. We don't know all of the details because we are obviously just on the edge of this. We're hearing bits and pieces. But we first heard about it toward the end of January that a large number of buzzards had been found dead in Cork, as you say, outside Timoleague. And NPWS, the National Parks and Wildlife Service, were investigating that incident. After a number of weeks, I began making contact with the National Parks and Wildlife Service to inquire what took place and maybe how the investigation was going, and had they any intention of bringing it into the public domain in order to maybe seek assistance from the general public in the area. Now, obviously, at the time, we were approaching the lockdown and so on and so forth, but I was in touch with different NPWS staff over a number of weeks. And eventually, just after Easter, I said, look, you really have to publicise this, the biggest bird of prey poisoning incident on record, because people need to know about it and need to know the risk. And apart from the buzzards that were unfortunately lost, people in that area of Cork need to know that somebody was putting out carbofuran. So eventually, on the 8th of May, the Golden Eagle Trust put it up on Facebook that this had happened, and we had a little traction. And then the next day, Birdwatch Ireland put it on their Facebook page. And because of their huge coverage across the country, a lot of people became aware of this, and some journalists started to ask questions. And the really heartening thing is that two of the local TDs, newly elected TDs, have come out very strongly and condemned it. And another third TD has also raised questions about this issue in the Dáil. So whilst it's a huge loss to the local buzzard population, I think the response from the general public just shows that these types of practices are no longer acceptable, and we're hoping that the National Parks have a pretty advanced plan on producing a new wildlife crime unit, which would help those managers who are struggling, or, you know, managers have a lot of different skill sets, and maybe there's some parts of the country where wildlife law enforcement is a little bit weaker than others, and that was identified by a Grant Thornton independent review of the National Parks and Wildlife Service in 2010. Just in summary, even though it's been a dreadful incident, I think the level of public interest and shock, and the public are kind of expecting our statutory authorities to do more in these cases.
So, Lorcan, just take us back now for a moment. These were buzzards. Buzzards are birds of prey that actually have spread back themselves across the country, like other ones, like the golden eagles or the white-tailed sea eagles were introduced. But these ones came on their own, and they spread back. They were formerly in the country, you know, a long time ago, but they became extinct to whatever carry-on that was going on with the different behaviours. But they came back by themselves now, and they are of absolutely no harm to any living thing. That these buzzards in particular are they feed on very small things. I mean, they're the farmer's friend. They feed on things like rats. They feed on things like fox cubs. They feed on things that the farmers would be delighted to have these buzzards on their side over their land. And as far as I know, the farmers all over the country are very pleased with buzzards, and the farmers would in no circumstances be trying to get rid of them, because my enemy's enemy is my friend. No farmer wants rats or vermin on his land. And if the buzzards can do this free, gratis and for nothing, a cade meal of falcha would be extended to them. So, you know, it's not a case of blaming farmers for this. This was actually an attack on a bird of prey using a terrible, terrible thing called carbofuran, which has been banned in this country for a very long time. It's no longer allowed to be used. It's no longer allowed to be put out to poison anything. And putting poison bait out with any kind of a poison, whether it's legal or not, is also a practice that is illegal as well. So,
Niall,
Yeah, it's really, really worrying to hear this. We've had an enormous response to this story on Bertrand's website and on social media. What really concerns me as well is just how horribly toxic this poison is, this carbifurin. I'm really worried that it's only a matter of time before a person is severely injured or even dies because of this substance. Because what happens is if someone went to, you know, they found a bird of prey in distress, or sometimes it's actually put on live bait. With the tether to the ground and it attracts in birds of prey. If someone went to the assistance of a bird like that and they happen to, you know, touch it with their hand and then touch their eye or the corner of their mouth, they could actually die from it. It's incredibly toxic. We've come across situations where bait has been put out. There's been enough poison on it to kill 200 adult people on just on one piece of bait. And it's worth stressing.
How come it doesn't damage the person who put it out? I mean, do they know that they are putting their own lives in danger, even putting out the poison?
I don't know. I can't speak for them. I don't even know what would motivate someone to do this in the first place. But it is a banned substance in Ireland. And it's quite separately as well, putting out any kind of poisoned meat bait of any kind in Ireland is completely illegal as well. So, you know, there's no excuse for this. There's nobody can say, oh, you know, this was an accident, I didn't intend this. It's a crime, and it is very important to stress that. But we've certainly been very heartened to see the wonderful outpouring of support for birds of prey as a result of this incident. I mean, 23 buzzards killed, that's absolutely disgusting. As you said in your introduction, Derek, that's the worst poisoning, mass killing of birds of prey on record in Ireland. But we know that local people in Timoleague and in that part of Cork have been absolutely horrified by this. And the support from local politicians, from the TDs, from the local landowners and farming community has been overwhelming.
Yeah, because wasn't the landowner upon whose land these birds fell dead brought it to the attention of the powers that be? So,
absolutely.
I mean, it wasn't that the landowner was in any way responsible. Somebody else had taken this law into their own hands.
Absolutely, and he was absolutely horrified by this. And, you know, so it's very good to see, obviously, the National Parks and Wildlife Service investigating this so thoroughly. You know, I hope there'll be prosecutions. I mean, the fact is, you know, that we need to do more in Ireland to tackle wildlife
crime. Yeah, what's the story on carbifurin? It's a banned substance, fine if it's used. But if I have a jar of it on my shed, can I be fined for having it in my possession?
See, that's the tricky area with it. And we have a situation where it is illegal to sell it and it's illegal to use it, but whether actually possessing it or not is a criminal offence, it's a grey area. We definitely think that the law needs to be tightened up in that area. There's no legitimate reason for anyone to have this. If people are wondering why this substance exists at all, it was originally used as a pesticide for crops, but it was banned in many, many countries because it was just so toxic. It was dangerous for people even to use it and it had a terrible effect on wildlife. And it also became well known as being a substance that would be abused by people to deliberately target birds of prey and to kill them. It's known that there are stocks of this in Ireland. It's known as well that in other countries that it has been imported from Ireland. It's been a big problem in Scotland, for example, and the origin is known to be Ireland for this substance. So it makes us as a country look very bad, and it's something that's very worrying. We trade on our green image, and we have, it's great to see these birds of prey finally coming back into our skies. As you said there, Aina, before, certainly the reintroduction happened for the two eagle species and for the red kite, but the buzzards came back completely naturally.
Yeah. So they're breeding all over the country. Now, where would a buzzard's nest be?
It's usually high in a tree, often in the middle of a stand of trees in a woodland.
So they're not on cliffs like the way Hackbald's Cross, Aina. Hackbald's Cross is in County Louth.
Exactly.
That's where I come from.
And Fado, I had a camera on a buzzard's nest. You just don't remember.
In Hackbald's
Because what happened was the buzzard then, I remember being told the buzzards may build two nests.
That's right.
Or more. So we had to decide.
Bring ourselves around and see which one we like, dear.
Which one do we put the camera on? And we had the most amazing pictures streaming from this nest site. And beautiful, the bird was coming, sitting there, never laid. Disappeared and went about 20 metres away to another tree. And that was the end of that game.
Because they're very conspicuous birds.
But it was in Hackbald's Cross, by the way. Sorry, that's why it came into my mind. It was a long time ago.
So, yeah, because that's on the East Coast and they spread from Scotland to the East Coast and then to the West
as they
are now. And, of course, they're huge birds. I mean, they're absolutely as big as eagles. You would think, we're not used to seeing these big birds in the sky. At least we weren't when they came first.
I know in parts of Scotland they would refer to them as the tourist eagle because people would think they'd seen a golden eagle. And you know, a buzzard is a big bird. The wingspan is over a metre. Now, compared to something like a golden eagle or a white-tailed eagle, they look small, but certainly the biggest bird that most people would see. And they're very conspicuous too. You see them soaring in the sky, particularly on a warm day like today. They like to ride in the thermals, the columns of warm air that rise up. And I often see them when I'm, back pre-COVID-19 situation, whenever I was driving on the M50, I would often see them perched on the lampposts. So they're more numerous now than people might realise. A lot of people have seen them and because they circle in the sky and they hear this mewing call like a distant cat. people are becoming more aware of them, and that's really
so
great to see.
What should people do then if they find something dead like this? I mean, who do you report a wildlife crime to? Is it the guards?
Well, the guards, yeah. We've had the guard on here talking about their investigations over the past few years. One guard in particular, I can't remember his name, it eludes me, but he's...
He was from North County to Dublin, I remember him.
Terrifically interested in this subject, but like most things, under-resourced, I'm afraid.
Absolutely, and also to the National Parks and Wildlife Service who enforce the Wildlife Acts, and they're very under-resourced. It's a real problem.
Could you tell the park ranger? I mean, each county has a ranger.
That's right. You have the National Parks and Wildlife Service ranger. I know their website is npws.ie, so you find the full contact lists there.
And would they tell Birdwatch Ireland?
If it's reported to Birdwatch Ireland, absolutely. We like to keep records of these things.
And of course, we'd advise...
Usually it would have to be reported by the person who has the evidence, but we would advise people on how to do that. So you can find birdwatchireland.ie. We have details on that story there.
All right. Well, thank you, Niall. And thank you to Lorcan O'Toole of the Golden Eagle Trust. You mentioned the coronavirus, COVID-19, and Richard Collins' big interview will be all about that after this break.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
This Monday, join us for an hour of RTE Concert Orchestra radio highlights from the past year. We've trawled the archives to bring you a range of amazing collaborations. Listen back to the orchestra with Villagers, Moving Hearts and Zoe Conway. Hear songs from a memorable Joni Mitchell tribute, country classics and lots more. That's Monday, June the 1st, 2 o'clock, RTE Radio 1.
Milk meets tea. Yogurt finds fruit. And the cheese makes the toasty. Calcium for bones, protein for muscles, and the vitamins and minerals our bodies need. Quality grass-fed butter for cake making and bread baking. Dairy. Irish, locally farmed freshness. For information on the role of dairy in a balanced diet, visit ndc.ie.
Calling all night owls. Cathal Murray here inviting you to join me for some escapism through music. Turn on and switch off to Late Date. Sunday to Thursday nights from 11 on RTE Radio 1.
Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
Don't forget you can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney.
We're holding this press briefing to confirm that Ireland has had its first case diagnosed of COVID-19. We were notified earlier this evening through the Health Protection Surveillance Centre by the National Virus Reference Laboratory of the diagnosis. The diagnosis relates to a male in the east of the country and arises as a result of return from one of the affected areas that's been identified, and in this particular case...
Dr. Tony Holohan there announcing the first coronavirus case confirmed in Ireland 3 long months ago. 2 weeks later, the first death due to the coronavirus is confirmed here on March 11th. The same day, the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a global pandemic. There are many thousands of scientists around the world examining the coronavirus, working on a vaccination, and many more trying to identify the next global killer. A central area of study are zoonotic diseases, meaning that they originate in animals. Studies have shown that 60% of emerging infectious diseases come from animals. Looking at how they transfer from animals to humans is central to the work of Professor Stephen Baker from the Department of Medicine at the University of Cambridge, previously with the Oxford University Clinical Research Unit in Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam. Stephen kept track on what was moving between which species in a bid to find the next pandemic. Earlier, he spoke with Richard Collins about his work.
Okay, so this is a fairly complicated process. Almost every infectious disease that there is in humans has originated at some point in animals. Humans have interactions with animals. Generally, what happens is that particular viruses or bacteria or other things circulate in specific animal species. And then occasionally one can make the jump from an animal species, often into another intermediate animal species, and then into humans. We do have interaction with animals, with domestic animals. Those of us that have pets, our dogs and cats would carry viruses that would be specific to them. But actually, we don't get sick from those, or we rarely get sick from those. The things that are of more concern Are there things that maybe we wouldn't come in contact with so often that we wouldn't have any background exposure to? And these are possibly the ones that are more dangerous. And our encroachment on wildlife, the destruction of living environments of many wildlife, the hunting of wildlife, actually puts us in closer contact with these things and arguably makes these things in certain parts of the world more likely to happen.
Now, you are at the apex of this study. You have been working in Vietnam. Now, the most conspicuous new virus sources are in the Far East and the so-called wet markets. You were going in there. You seem to me to be a kind of Linnaeus of the viral world. You're trying to sort them out and classify them and put them into various categories and determine lines of succession and so on and forth. Is this a valid description of what you do?
It's probably slightly less Indiana Jones than that. There's quite a lot of traveling to field sites, identifying particular places that we could sample, taking samples from humans and animals, and then doing some characterization of what's in those and trying to pull the viruses apart from them. So we have done a fair degree of that. And yeah, wet markets, but also other locations where people are in sustained occupational exposure to animal populations, such as farmers, particularly wildlife farmers. In parts of Asia, there are people that hunt wildlife, particularly bats and these other things. We believe that these people are at higher risk of these infections than others. Therefore, we performed a project to then sample animals, but also sample people that came in close contact with these animals on a regular basis.
So you have people whose blood you check for viruses at regular intervals, and you can see whether they picked up new ones and so forth. Do you work at the animal level and look at what is... I've been in these markets in Vietnam, and they're smelly, fascinating places, but not places you would dwell in for very long. Do you go in there and look at what's going on, where the animals are approximate to, and who they're rubbing shoulders with and things like this? Do you work at that level?
Yeah, sure. So we've spent a lot of time working with people in markets and trying to understanding the occupational risks of how the animals are farmed initially, but also then how they may be prepared and butchered in the market as well. So try to identify what the risk factors. So who may be at higher risk than others through procedures that are being conducted in the market, such as, you know, the storing of live animals and the potential for bites or scratches, but also then the butchering of animals within the market and the risk from sharp objects, but also then, you know, the interaction between blood and other potential fluids from the animal, which may be exposing the people working within the markets.
So you are watching for new viruses. I believe there are 6,000 described viruses. It seems an enormous number. And there are countless others, and we're surrounded by them. Now, is this a kind of needle in a haystack pursuit, finding one that is new and dangerous?
Yes, it is. So I conducted this, you know, this project was done over a 5-6 year period in Vietnam, and we did do a lot of documentation of different viruses, and we could find similar viruses between animals and humans. And occasionally we could link them potentially with people that had been working with certain types of animals that would have these viruses in their stools or in their respiratory secretions. But actually identifying it when it's going to happen is essentially a needle in a haystack. If I'd have been doing this project in China at the end of last year, then we would have been in a position then to document this whole procedure all the way through from the virus potentially circulating in animals first and then making this jump from an intermediate animal species potentially into humans.
The nearest scientific equivalent, it seems to me, is the asteroid monitor. And people who look at objects hurtling towards us in space and try to predict the trajectory of the item in order to warn us that something is coming. You were in a similar situation trying to predict which virus is going to strike and how bad it will be. Can you tell me a little bit about the virus? If you were a virus, no, a virus isn't a living thing, but if we can pretend it's alive for a moment, a virus' first task is to try to get into a cell, a key to insert in a lock, is it?
Yeah, there's lots of potential arguments about the viability of viruses and whether they're living entities or not. The difference between viruses and other things, such as the cells that are within us, but also bacteria, is that viruses cannot replicate themselves. So they don't have the machinery to make copies of themselves like our cells do and like the way bacteria do. What they do is they need to get inside particular types of cell, and then they actually use our machinery to then copy themselves and then explode out the cell to go and infect other cells. So that's the way viruses work. To get into different types of cells, it's not so simple. They can't infect any cell. There needs to be an interaction with a particular receptor on the surface of the cell to make sure they can make that interaction to allow it to get inside the cell. So that's where a lot of the kind of host restriction, if you like. So what I mean by that is that the viruses are specific to different species that have different receptors on top of their cells. If there is a change in the virus, particularly in the bit that allows it to attach to different types of cells, then it may become a possibility that it could then bind to human cells and then form this infection process within human cells.
Well, now, is this a process which covers several animals? It's been suggested that bats infected pangolins and they infected people and so on. It's a kind of chain thing, is it?
Yeah, that's the general hypothesis. So bats, we know, are a very large source of a huge diversity of different types of viruses for various reasons. Bats are a very old mammalian species. They have a different type of immune system, and actually they don't get sick with the viruses they're infected with, which allows them then to just maintain them for long periods. So they can be infected with very dangerous viruses to humans, but they don't cause the bats any problems. Now, for them to get into humans, just because we get infected with a bat virus, it doesn't mean it's going to cause an infection. Because the receptors, if you like, of how the virus binds to bat cells would be very different to the way they are on human cells. So often there may be an intermediate host, so something that's a bit in between. In this case, the pangolins has been stated, but also we know other intermediate species. You mentioned rats and other things potentially. There is a potential then for a virus to get into large numbers, into different animal species, which may have similar receptors to humans and then form an intermediate stepping stone, if you like, for the ability then to cause infections in humans.
Suppose I manage to get in and I have commanded a cell and I'm replicating myself within the person. My next task is to spread my wings. So I need, if for instance, the case of COVID, does this engineer sneezing and infection, which generates sneezing and coughing and so on, as a way of getting itself around? Or is that an extreme suggestion?
The virus is not conscious, so it isn't aware of what it's doing. But actually, yeah, it's essentially a piece of genetic information inside a protein parcel that wants to get itself as well distributed, if you like, as much as possible. So therefore, it infects the cells, it then invades different cells to make a large amounts of it, of itself. It copies itself, it essentially photocopies itself inside the cell. And then you sneezing and coughing, as we've found out quite obviously from events of the last few months, but also with other respiratory viruses such as flu and rhinovirus, which causes the common cold, they use this as a mechanism from spreading to host. So by us sneezing and coughing the virus out, it makes sure that the virus can then survive and go on to infect other cells in other people.
And so a virus must be careful, must it, not to kill its host. It's some kind of a cuckoo situation. The cuckoo lays an egg and eliminates the reproduction of its host. It's on a hiding to nowhere if it keeps that up. So a virus that would kill its host would not succeed. You have to engineer a system whereby you don't kill the host, you just make the host sick. So it will continue sneezing and coughing until such time as you are spread everywhere. Is that the model?
Correct, and that's a really accurate definition of the way most things that cause us infections survive and are successful within humans. Viruses specifically, there is a very fine balance between making sure that we're sick enough for long enough to then transmit the virus on to others, but also not to kill us, because there is no real longitudinal advantage of the virus to survive indefinitely if it kills its host directly. So there is a balance then between the transmission of the virus, but also then the pathogenicity, which is the ability of the virus to cause an infection. And actually often, such as again been defined by the activities of the last few months with coronavirus here, it has a very fine balance between having enough disease severity to cause an infection, and also it does kill a proportion of the population, but not enough to limit its transmission onto other people. So it seems to be really quite well adapted to this transmission process to cause enough infection to sustain itself and then cause the pandemic that we've observed.
So it's a whole new ball game now, vis-a-vis what it was in the past. Even the 1918 flu, Spanish flu, so-called, the progress there was rather slow. After all, trains and ships were the main vectors carrying people back from the trenches and so forth. But nowadays, it must be a totally different ball game. It must be, how bad is it, or how panicky should we be?
The way we kind of considered our infectious disease risk in modern history has been largely focused on the problems that appear to affect ourselves here in Western Europe, really. We've managed, with improvements of sanitation and hygiene over the last 100 years, to have a huge impact on infectious diseases. Other places in the world have not had the same impact on infectious diseases due to slower development, and also then the potential emergence of new infections from these environmental destructions and other ways of life that may not be so familiar to us. So what's really changed then, and particularly highlighted by the ongoing pandemic, is that we can't afford to ignore what's going on elsewhere in the world. The next big thing that is likely to be the next big pandemic after this, and there will be another one at some point, is going to arise outside of Western Europe, and it's going to emerge probably from Asia or Africa and then end up on our doorsteps through international travel. And only by investing and having more effort and understanding how these things work and what to do when they arrive on our shores can we really have any chance of combating them.
Professor Stephen Baker of Cambridge University, speaking earlier with Richard Collins. Thank you very much indeed, Richard. We asked a question. We told you we had a competition. And the prize is, before I give you the answer, a one-year membership for Birdwatch Ireland. You're looking for members, Niall Hatch. I'm sure you'll be delighted with members.
We would, absolutely. So for wildlife charities like Birdwatch Ireland, these are very tough times. I mean, I should have been spending all this weekend at Bloom in the Phoenix Park recruiting members, our biggest event of the year. We really need the help. So if you don't win the competition, you can still go to birdwatchireland.ie and join as a member there. We really need the help. Thank you.
Well, the question was, what has Greta Thunberg got in common with this lady singing? And her name is Malena Ernman, and she represented Sweden in the Eurovision Song Contest in 2009. Can you keep a secret? I'm in love with you. And a beautiful singer she is too. Didn't win, needless to say, but let me tell you that hundreds and thousands of you took part in this competition. But the winner is Attracta Brownlee from County Sligo, and Attracta has rightly said it's her mother.
So she has DNA in common.
She's got DNA in common. Terry Flanagan has dropped back in. Terry, yeah.
Lots of calls, lots of tweets and lots of texts in about terrapins. Just give you one or two. Hi, Derek. We have terrapins on the lakes in Tymon Park. That's in Talla. Two on one particular lake for the past 3 years at least. They are regularly seen sunning themselves together with the grey heron, and they sent in a photograph. That was from Brian McCormack. And one here on Twitter from Dazoo77. There's a great name, isn't it? I was waiting for a train at Leixlip Louisa Bridge during a warm weather spell. A guy beside me was looking into the Royal Canal and spotted what he described as a turtle.
But it was a
terrapin.
Terrapin. We have Maeve on the line who wants to ask very quickly about a hedgehog. Hello, Maeve.
Hello, Derek. It's Maeve here from gorgeous Yall today.
Oh, it sounds delicious. Go on, tell us what's your story.
Magic. Come here to me. I have a little hedgehog that comes every evening and we feed him. Just a little food, just to keep him going. And he takes care of all the slugs and snails in our garden. However, if we want to ensure he's nice and comfy, I believe there's a hedgehog house you can put in the garden. And I'm wondering if any of your panel would be able to help me as to where and what aspect that little house or construction should be of, and where I can put it, please.
All right, thank you very much indeed.
Well, now I think the hedgehog house is to make the owner of the hedgehog happy, or the person in the garden, because hedgehogs will not be wanting to be inside in a hedgehog house, actually, except when they're hibernating in the winter time, so she can get her hibernaculum for the hedgehog and put it in a disused corner of the garden beside the shed for the winter. But in this time of the year, the hedgehog is out at night, out looking for slugs and snails, very dry at the moment. So I'm glad that you're feeding him, Maeve. What are you giving him?
I'm actually using just a supermarket cat food in a sachet, a wet one.
Yeah, because you meant to give them meat, so I'm just glad you're doing that. That's the right thing to do. What you don't want to be giving them, and people do sometimes, is to give them milk, or to give them bread or bread and milk. That's all wrong, because the hedgehogs are carnivores. And of course, the other thing then, of course, is you're obviously not doing this, but people should not be putting out blue pellets and poisoning the slugs and snails, because they may be getting rid of some slugs and snails, but they're poisoning poor Harry the Hedgehog as well. And you want Harry the Hedgehog to be doing the work. Keep the food chain going.
Maeve, thank you very much indeed. In lovely y'all this afternoon. This evening, it's almost 7 o'clock. That's pretty much all we have time for. By the way, I mentioned a Garda earlier on. I couldn't remember his name. It's Superintendent Martin Walker, and he's stationed in County Kildare. And if you want to hear more of Aina, you can listen to Desi's Island Discs next Thursday at 6:30 p.m. right here on RT Radio 1, because Des has done a big interview with our Aina. That's all we have time for. My thanks to Terry Flanagan, to Niall Hatch of Birdwatch Ireland. You know what to do. You got to do if you want to become a member. My thanks to Aina Lana and Richard Collins, to Jarlath and to John and everybody else, and Tom, who was on sound today. That's all we have time for. Do it all next week. Talk to you then. Bye bye.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.